Welcome to episode 2 of 8 of the Harvey Hunt series on the Warrior Next Door podcast. In this series of episodes, we follow the experiences of Marine Corporal Harvey Hunt of the 2nd Battalion of the 23rd Regiment, the 4th Marine Division, as he fights across 4 island battlefields of the Pacific during World War II. In episode 1, we heard about Harvey's enlistment, training, and first action in the Battle of Roi Namur on the Atoll of Kwajalein. Join us now as we hear about his experience in the invasion of Saipan.
This is the Warrior Next Door podcast, where we're going to feature interviews that were collected, conducted by Ryan Fairfield and myself, Tony Lupo, for the Veterans History Project at the Library of Congress. The focus of this podcast is not going to be on world leaders or events that led to World War II. It's not going to be about general strategy. It's going to be about the everyday GI soldiers and their experience. Welcome to our journey.
Yeah, so what you're going to hear in the next series of clips is he survived Kwajalein. Half of his fire team didn't. They died very violent deaths very early on the landing beaches. But he survived. They go back to Hawaii. They refit. They reform. And so in Kwajalein, that was invaded in January of 1944. Now we're talking about middle of June, June 15th, 1944. So about 6 months later, to go back to Hawaii, refit, reform, re-equip, sail out to Saipan, which was basically, Saipan looks like an upside down F. It's got 2 points on the bottom on the south. It's about 12 miles long. And unlike Kwajalein, which was a coral atoll, which was relatively flat, the Marianas, which is a group of islands as part of this campaign, were very rugged. They're a lot like Hawaii, where you would have had a lot of vegetation, a lot of terrain. And the Marianas campaign actually involved 3 different islands, 3 different landings. The first one was in Saipan, and the second one was Tinian. And while that one was ongoing, Guam was also invaded. So you had 3 islands that were part of this. And the reason why the United States wanted Saipan was because for the first time, you could take our long-range bombers, our B-29s, and attack and bomb the Japanese homeland. And the Japanese knew this. And so the Japanese fought ferociously and did everything they could to reinforce these islands because they knew it meant that the Americans were in striking distance. There were 3 towns on Saipan and a population of about 30,000 civilians, which meant that for the first time, the Marines were going to have to learn how to fight in urban areas. So each of these islands had their own unique characteristics and challenges to have you overcome. And for Saipan, it was for the first time you had a large civilian population on the island. And a lot of this would end up with tragic results. So here's what the Marines were facing. Working with aerial photographs, and so a lot of this information I'm getting comes from Ian W. Toll's wonderful book on the Conquering Tide, along with other sources, but primarily this one. So working with aerial photographs and radio intercepts, the American intelligence analyst estimated that there's around 15,000 to 17,000 troops, but it turned out that because of the importance of this island and because of the sense of urgency that the Japanese military had of reinforcing it, there was actually the actual troop strength was almost 30,000. So there were quite a few troops on this island. And the other thing that's really interesting about Saipan is the type of force that we were able to bring to bear in not just Saipan, but in the Marianas campaign. So here's a couple of quotes to kind of give you a high-level overview of what we were able to do as a country at this time. So it reads, if not for invasion of northern France, which was overlord,
which was happening at about the same time.
Which was happening at about the same time.
Yep.
So these are contemporaneous invasions. If not for the invasion of northern France with Overlord, which is D-Day when we think of D-Day, the Pacific operation, which this one in the Marianas is called Forager, would have surpassed all previous amphibious landings in scale and sophistication. Because you've got 3 islands you're attacking and you have Japanese carriers coming in. There was a lot more degrees of freedom for things to go wrong with something like this. that two such colossal assaults could be launched against fortified enemy shores at the same time at opposite ends of the Eurasian landmass is described as a supreme demonstration of the American military-industrial hegemony. And in fact, let's do a little quick comparison here. So it's been about 2 years since Guadalcanal. We were able to bring to bear a task force that had 600 ships carrying more than 300,000 men for Operation Forager for the Marianas. Remember, contemporaneous with what's going on in D-Day in Europe. In Guadalcanal, we had 75 ships with 16,000 men. So we went from being able to scrounge up 75 ships and transports to being able to deploy 600 ships and transports. And all we had available as a quick strike force back in 42 was about 16,000 Marines of the 1st Division. And now we had 300,000 men, 127,000 of those being Marines from the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th Division, along with the Army's 27th Division. It was absolutely amazing. In fact, here's an eyewitness account from an F-6F pilot who is flying above Task Force 58. By the way, the Task Force 58, which is the name of the task force for Forager, when it sailed out of Eniwetok to the invasion beaches, to the Marianas, it took 5 hours for those ships to leave the lagoon. 5 hours. And here's what an F-6F pilot saw flying over this task force. During the five-day passage from Eniwetok to Saipan, he was impressed by the sight of the fleet as it turned into the wind to launch aircraft. Carriers, battleships, cruisers, destroyers turned together and steadied on the same course. Quote, the wakes from all of those ships were perfectly symmetrical with each other. It was like a sort of a ballet. But some of these ships weighed 35,000 tons. I looked down on this power and wondered what kind of fool these Japanese were. They had made one of the greatest miscalculations of all time, and boy, were they going to pay the price.
And then you said that's from which one?
That's from Ian Toll's book, The Conquering Tide, and it's from an F-6F pilot who had a bird's eye view of this task force going to Saipan. And we've interviewed other sailors and soldiers who participated in Saipan. We'll cover them in future interviews. And they talk about being able to look around them and just be absolutely in awe. It was a sort of a balm. It gave them comfort. Like, unlike the earlier campaigns, which were on shoestrings and the Navy was getting blown out of the water, they knew that something different was occurring, that this was a different type of American force than what we started the war with.
Well, you're exactly 2 years later, very nearly 2 years after Guadalcanal. Guadalcanal was August of 42. Mm-hmm. And in those 2 years, we went from, you know, just getting going with our war effort to obviously now having just a gigantic Navy.
In fact, another reference from this book from Ian Toll is that for every Marine or soldier in a landing force, the transport fleet carried more than a ton of supplies and equipment. So here we go from early in the war, scrounge together 75 ships, put a division on there, attack Guadalcanal, and just hang on by the skin of our teeth. And now here it is a couple years later, and each man has 2,000 pounds worth of kit ready for him, food, ammunition, medicines, whatever it's going to be. And there's 600 ships, you know, floating around Marianas and going out, keeping the Japanese away from the invasion beaches. That's another problem we had at Guadalcanal. We couldn't keep the Japanese away from our invasion beaches. Battleships rolled through the slot and actually bombed our soldiers on Guadalcanal. Our Navy was impotent, could do nothing about it. That was not what was going to happen this mm-hmm. time. This is going to be very, very different.
We loaded out in about mid-April on LSTs, which had LCTs on top. And our accommodations aboard the LST was on cots underneath the LCT. The only accommodations they had on the LST for the Marines was the officers, and they did have quarters for them. We arrived off the coast of Saipan around the 1st or 2nd part of June, and it was being subjected to the heavy shelling by battleships and heavy cruisers and destroyers, plus being bombed constantly. We boarded their landing vehicles, and I was assigned as a machine gunner on a 50 caliber on the amphibian tractor. And I said, well, what gun am I to shoot at? And he said, just shoot at the shoreline. Well, if you've ever been on one of those, every wave you hit goes up and drops and up and drops. And I shot more in the air or more in the water than anywhere else. And then we rode the amphibs about 1,500 yards in. There was a ridge that went down the center of Saipan. We rode to the top of that ridge. We went all the way through the Japs' shore defenses to this ridge. We piled out, and then no more got in a perimeter to start defending ourselves or advancing whatever we were ordered to do. And the riflemen in our fire team got shot through the leg. I was trying to get him bandaged up, and another guy in our squad got hit. And since I was bandaging the guy in my fire team, they decided that I'd ought to be the guy responsible to take him back to the battalion aid station, which was on the beach. Well, we just driven through all the Japs to this ridge, and so to go back, we had to go back through the Japs, and we got fired at a number of times in trying to reach the beach. We finally made it after, three or four firefights. And I reported as instructed to the first officer I saw so that I could get back to my unit. And he happened to be a forward observer for the artillery. So he said, yeah, I'll take you back to your unit, but first you're gonna have to go up on the front lines with me. So I got in the Jeep and we went up, and I spent 3 days on the front line with the forward observer. And he finally decided he could take me back to my unit. So I got back and I reported to my commanding officer, Captain Padley. And he said, Hunt, you've had your vacation. Get out there on point.
Well, let's talk about this vacation that he went on. So he talked about having, first off, they had the alligator, it's armed, the amphibious tractor. They crashed through the main line of resistance of the Japanese, which is amazing. That's called a breakthrough, right? But then one of his guys gets injured, and he is being tasked, because it's on his fire team, of bringing this person back through the gauntlet.
Yeah, 1,500 yards they've gone in, yep. Almost a mile.
And they're just rocking and rolling, and now he's got to go back through that.
On foot.
There's plenty of Japanese behind them because they just drove through them. He has to firefight his way there. He makes it to the beach. And then a forward observer says, hey, this is what's really awesome about what the Marines can do with their training is the Marines could be like Swiss Army knives. You could move them to different places on the battlefield and reconstitute units that were lost very quickly because of their training. But the forward observer, for those who think that it's just some guy sitting in some tower somewhere with binoculars looking down on the battlefield, that's not it. So here is his commanding officer, when he comes back after he's been gone for three days, is like, well, you've had your vacation, now run point. Well, let me tell you about his vacation. Here's a quote from someone observing, a forward observer. It may have been the guy, for all we know, that Harvey was working with, but this would have been pretty common. To tell you what he had to do. So this is from the Ian Toll book again. So he quotes, I lost his name, unfortunately, but this guy was one brave son of a bitch. He would ask for gunfire in such and such a place, often within a few yards of his foxhole, and would relay the coordinates and give me to the gunnery officer. First fire, then the deafening explosion, then pause while the 57-pound shell streaked toward the target, followed by the comment from our unseed buddy, the Ford observer, saying things like, fan-f***ing-tastic, or bullseye. And sometimes, that was a little close, friends. Back off a blonde one. So that was his vacation. The Ford observer was in the trenches, getting shot at, getting killed, It was Harvey's job to protect him.
Yeah, right.
Right. And so he does all this stuff. He runs the gauntlet. He brings his injured friend back. He's stuck in the front lines doing this stuff. And then he comes back and his CO gives him shit because he was on a vacation.
On vacation.
Here, go take point. Okay. We'll continue with this clip.
Can you describe what sort of things you saw when you were helping the guy as a Ford Observer? What was the role? What were you guys doing?
Well, I was just up there to help defend him.
Got it.
Since I was assistant BAR man, he thought I could help him defend their position.
Sure.
Hey, you're on the front line with the Ford Observer.
Yes, you are.
As the assistant BAR, did you carry a grand or anything like that? Or
yeah, I carried a rifle.
Gotcha.
But everybody, once you were in combat on Saipan, anybody carrying an automatic weapon is going to be shot at.
Yeah.
Because it's got a lot of firepower. Mm-hmm. And of course, it didn't. The BAR man, by the time I got back to the unit, he'd already been wounded or killed one of the other. And I assumed the role of the BAR man then. And we were 33 or 34 days, they declared the island secure. But we had to, as they call it, mopping up. We had to get them all out of the caves. And we got more than one Marine killed after they declared the island secured because of getting them out of the caves.
What was the tactics you'd use to try to get him out? Did you just kind of seal the cave up?
Well, we had flamethrowers. Mm-hmm. And you would fire the BAR men, and everybody would fire into the mouth of the cave. And the BAR men would go up and shoot a blast of napalm in there. Mm-hmm. He has a flamethrower. He's a flamethrower man. And he would blast that cave with that, and it sucks the oxygen out of the air. And sometimes they'd come out, sometimes they didn't.
But yeah, so the flamethrower was a weapon du jour on these island campaigns where by this time in the war, the Japanese knew because of Kwajalein, because of Tarawa, because of what was going on at the same time in the southern Pacific as MacArthur was coming up into the Philippines, the Japanese were dug in. This wasn't a continental type warfare where you had mobile lines that were fluid and moving and war and maneuver. This was a grungy war of attrition, and people died with the utmost violence because of that. And flamethrowers were extremely common to just spray them into these caves and kill who was ever in there.
I mean, well, if I can interject here, you know, you never see flamethrowers really being used in the European theater. You see them being used in the Pacific theater by the flamethrower guys and from tanks also that were shooting napalm, you know, from a distance. Mm-hmm. The nature and the reason for that, I think, is the nature of the enemy and how he used his surroundings to defend himself and to go on offense. The only way we could really root the Japanese out or to neutralize them, you know, they were dug into every one of these coral islands or volcanic islands where they were. And so who wants to go into a cave in a tunnel system and have combat underground where they know what's going on underneath there, but you don't? The best thing you can do is stay above ground and take them out, let them die underground. This, as barbaric as it seems, is the best way to do it. You know, it's a war of attrition. It's brutal warfare.
And because of the nature of the Japanese soldier and the terrain, in this next clip, you're going to hear Harvey talk about some of the losses that were incurred during this type of island campaign.
But that kind of ended the combat for our platoon. We wound up. We lost about half of them, I guess, wounded and killed in our platoon on Saipan. And we didn't get any reinforcements when we went to Tinian. We used just what we had.
So this is something that, you know, Saipan and Tinian, before we interviewed Harvey, I was completely ignorant of the Pacific battlefield. I'd heard of these islands. But Saipan and Tinian were invaded back to back. They were a twofer, you know, it was a tandem. And it wasn't as if they were reinforced. They went there knowing they were going to invade one island, and then hopefully that invasion went well. Now, I know that General Howland Smith was ordered to take Saipan in 3 days. The reason being, they figured they would minimize their losses. They'd have enough fighting men left over to go into Tinian. Well, that campaign lasted 30 days mm-hmm. in Saipan. And, you know, do you have their casualties offhand on Saipan?
I do. I was going to put it in the wrap up, but the bottom line is that we lost about 3,000 soldiers on Saipan, and the Japanese, you know, lost their garrison of over 24,000.
So Harvey and his guys, they go back to their ship at the end of Saipan. They get fed, cleaned up. They get refitted with their gear. They move over a few miles and they invade Tinian, you know, and so without any reinforcements. So whatever they had for a group and Marines that were still capable of fighting, they had to continue on with and take a second island.
I was blown away by that too. I thought that the template was you roll into an island, you end up staying there longer than you have to because of how the Japanese fight, how tenacious they were. And then you would go to some rear area base or even back to Hawaii and re-quip, refit, recover.
Get some R&R.
And then do it again. But no, these guys went on Saipan, endured all of the hellaciousness that's associated with island warfare. And then in just a few weeks, they were just going to go to Tinian and invade the island, which is right across from Saipan. It's just 3.5 miles away. We're going to get to Tinian here more in a minute. But the bottom line is that was something I didn't appreciate either. It was just, bam, get on the ship, clean up, get some food, bam, go do another island. I don't know how any of these guys thought they were going to survive the war.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I read when I was reading accounts from the brass on, you know, what the morale was of these guys. They had just come off of Tinian after 30 days of hard fighting. And they remarked at how, you know, when they were told they were going to be going and taking Tinian next, the morale, as so they saw it, was actually pretty good, you know, and they remarked at how amazed they were that the Marines took this next invasion like, well, okay, I guess we'll go do this, you know. So, you know, I got to hand it to these guys. I can't get over the strong fighting spirit they had and, you know, what they had to endure.
Can I ask you a few more questions about Saipan?
Yeah.
Since we're on it. You were in a unique position on the amphibious landing vehicle of being a 50 cal gunner. Everyone else was hunkered down, right?
Yeah.
And you were up there. What did you see? What was your...
you were with the thing going up and down, and you're trying to sight the 50 caliber, and, you know, you're shooting burst.
Yeah.
And about the time you get ready to shoot the cotton-picking thing... raise up, you know, and you'd shoot an arrow, and you'd get ready to shoot when it's coming down, and it'd come down faster than you'd anticipate.
But could you see enemy fire on the beach, coming return fire?
No,
nothing.
They had covered that thing with so much, Navy.
Once you landed on the beach, you described basically you took these amphibious tractors and drove. You said right through
up to the ridge in the middle of the island.
And at that point, some of your men started getting wounded. Could you?
Well, we got out of the amphib, and he turned around and goes back.
Yeah.
And they're armored, you know. They're fairly sick. But then the only way we could get our wounded back was somebody had to take them. Didn't have any transportation. Yeah. And you don't have anybody from headquarters up there with a jeep or anything to help. You just have to carry them. But the two guys I had were both ambulatory. And one of them you had to help, you know, because you'd been hit in the leg and you had to hold on to it. But we still had our weapons, so we got fired at. We dropped down and tried to protect ourselves.
So did the Japanese not have any sort of like a like RPG or anything to take out these Amtraks with?
The only time I ever saw them, they had tanks, and they came at us on Saipan. We were right. They attacked us immediately when we landed on the ridge. But our the ship's fire was directed by somebody, some forward observer someplace. Could have been arrow. And they really took care of those tanks. Then our tanks got there, we had no problem. They were, the Japs were no match for our tanks at all. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so one of the things that Harvey doesn't go into detail about is what the scene would have been like on the beach that he had to go back to or through. So he talks about having an amphib bring him, you know, past the beach, past the mainline resistance, onto the ridge. But here's a quote from Lieutenant Robert B. Sheeks. Again, this is from Ian Toll's book, The Conquering Tide, about what was going on at the beach at the time when they were bringing their wounded back. And he writes that he was crawling up on the beach when a mortar shell hit two Marines immediately to his left. Quote, there was an explosion, and these two guys, they just evaporated. We couldn't see any sign of them. They were disintegrated, just mixed in with the sand and the vegetation and scattered all over the place. So,
horrific.
It is horrific. It's you know, I think when we listen to these veterans say, well, we brought this wounded guy here, we moved there, we did this other thing, we can't fully appreciate all these other elements of the battle that were going on that they would have experienced, that by this time, like you said earlier, their training took over and they were numb to it and just kept going.
Yeah.
You know, one thing I wanted to comment on before we continue, one of the things that I've heard about the Marines, and when you described in your training that you were immediately signed to the 3rd Fire Team, the 3rd Squad, 3rd Platoon, before you even left the United States.
Yeah.
And, you know, to me that, I think the Army didn't used to do it that way. I mean, did you kind of get formed in the Army? You're kind of formed into your group and your platoon when you're over there. And it sounds like that you could build a good esprit de corps, you know, when you train.
Well, you got to realize that the Marine Corps is much smaller than the Army. Mm-hmm. They're inducting, you know, millions, and Marine Corps is inducting thousands. Mm-hmm. So the whole idea behind the Marine Corps was that they wanted you as a unit who knew one another, you know, and what you expected of one another.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that made it more difficult when you lost guys because the units were smaller and people knew each other more?
Well, it's tough to lose anybody, but right. That's combat. There's nothing you can do about that. It's just combat.
How did you handle that when you saw your first casualties, guys you knew? How did you?
I kept my head down for a minute.
Got it.
Yeah, okay. And by then, you know, the other people were coming ashore, and there was enough of them around that we could. They evidently started shooting somebody else because I got up, didn't get shot.
So there's been repeated attempts by us as interviewers to try to get, you know, this visceral reaction that they had to something they experienced during the war. And oftentimes, as a coping mechanism, they would use humor. They would try to stay as light as they could. Some of the people we interview would talk in detail about it, but most of them, whether it's during an interview or we go to the reunion, will do what we just saw Harvey do here. And I can't tell you how many times I've gone to the hospitality room in a reunion, and you'll hear the guys making jokes about the fact that they tell the same stories over and over again when they come together. They're the funny stories. And you're going to hear this as we go through these clips where he'll tell you about something, but he's not really ready to, or willing or able to really share with us the specific things that he felt at the time that some of these things were occurring. He's found a way to cope with that and to use humor to do it in funny stories.
Could you describe, and then this last question I have while we're in Saipan, what was the noise and atmosphere like when you got out of the Amtraks? Was it pretty quiet, or was it just a maelstrom of noise?
Well,
what do you remember?
An Amtrak has an airplane motor in it, and you can't hear yourself think when you're on that. And they don't wait around once you're out of there. They're gone. They don't wait around because they don't have any firepower that they can defend themselves with other than the 50 caliber machine guns, 30. But the Navy gunfire, and that's anywhere from the 14 inches down to the 5 inches, are just pouring the lead in there, you know. It's just continuous fire. We pulled around one of the battleships, I don't remember which one it was now, it's been so long ago. But in our, when we started towards the beach, we were behind the battleship, and we had to go around him, and we went around and they pulled back into line and just got back in line, and he fired a 14-inch, like it blew us out of the water.
Really? So you could, yeah, clearly the air was impressive.
Flattened things out in front of us.
Now, I've heard stories that you could actually see the larger projectiles flying through the air.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you can watch them.
Really?
You watch them, they look like they cross.
No kidding.
Yeah. And some of them have tracers. And I guess that is to be sure that they know exactly, you know, their rounds, because so many of them being fired, they need to know where they're hitting, mm-hmm. whether they're on target or not. Mm-hmm. So they use some method to trace their rounds.
Yeah, and so I got another little statistic here from Ian Toll's book about the weight of naval firepower that he speaks of. And it's quoted here, that 11,000 tons of naval ordnance fell on Saipan. And with such a superabundance of firepower in Yawthing, the call fire coordinates did not always limit their targets to known enemy locations. In fact, when Nimitz was telling King about his after-action report on Forager, with this is the campaign in the Marianas, he wrote that, it quote, it was often employed, the firepower, against an area where enemy installations were only suspected rather than known to exist. And why not? So long as the ammunition resupply train, staging from any WETOC, continually replenished the fleet's magazines. Mm-hmm. So this just reinforces what we were saying earlier, that the United States was in a very different position, an enviable position. I would argue a position that maybe no other major power in the world at that time had the ability to do, which is to go to an island like Saipan and Tinian and deliver 11,000 tons of naval ordnance, even in areas that they thought, well, maybe there's Japanese there. That again, this is the sort of thing that allows the morale of the troops fighting on the ground to be elevated.
Mm-hmm.
They fire their aircraft guns. They fire everything they got on the beach. Mm-hmm. Then they had these LSTs that had nothing but rockets on. I don't know how many, just rockets, rack after rack after rack. And the air is just filled with those things. Some of those rockets would, you know, start tumbling. And, you know, you didn't know whether they're going to come down on you or whether they're going to get over you. Mm-hmm.
Did it have an effect on the morale, seeing all that firepower being projected?
Well, you think that there can't be anybody left, but that's not true.
Yes, there were.
Yeah, they had dug in, or dugouts, or whatever you want to call them, pill boxes that were covered with coconut logs and probably 4 or 5 feet of earth. And it took a pretty close, you know, good direct hit to knock them out.
With them being as dug in as they were, how often did you see any Japanese soldiers as you guys were pushing across the island? Was it pretty rare?
We didn't see anybody till going up there.
Yep.
Because, of course, they were all hunkered down because of the fire that was coming in.
But, I mean, once you were on the island, you guys started forming a skirmish line. Did you see?
Well, when we not on Saipan. We rode the amphibs in.
Yep.
Of course, all the amphibs tried to make it in to this ridge that ran across there. But you lose contact. So the first thing we did was set up a perimeter defense and get organized and try to make contact with the other squads or other platoons, anybody you could get in contact with, so you don't know, you know, so you don't start having friendly firefights. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much.
So at the end of the Saipan battle, what happened after that?
We loaded up on the LSTs again, and they took us out offshore, and of course they did that so that we could get cleaned up and it's good meals. We've been on K rations for over a month, and you're only supposed to have them for 3 days or something like that. But we found out that the cotton picking tankers all had 10-1 rations. 10-1 rations had bacon, stew, and all kinds of good food.
Were they taking them from the?
No, they were issued it.
Oh,
because they have a crew.
Got it.
They got five driver. They got five driver, assistant driver, the commander, and the loader, and the guy, one other guy that passes the ammunition. But they couldn't see us because they would be looking in front, and we'd jump up there and heist their 10-1 rations. And that's the only time we ever got any good thing to eat while we were in combat, is just simply getting it off of the tankers. And they finally got to where they'd load up some extra ones and toss them off as they came up.
What'd the K ration consist of?
Crackers, cheese, and they had minced ham, and the odor would knock you down when you took the cap of it off. And the C ration is another ration. It had canned hash and pork and beans, and I forgot there was one out of three of them, but they were a little better than the K ration. K ration was just, well, K ration had a chocolate bar in it. It had some weird brand of cigarettes I'd never heard of before, and they tasted terrible. They had salt tablets for your canteen. And that's about all I can remember they had in there. But it wasn't very much.
So how much weight did you lose while you were on Saipan?
Oh, probably 15 pounds. I didn't have much weight. I only weighed 130 pounds.
So you didn't have much to lose. So basically, after the battle, they put you on the LSTs, and you're basically trying to get you guys back in shape.
Well, we needed to get cleaned up. Yeah. You know, we hadn't been able to take a shower or anything. You couldn't swim. We were born in the line all the time. So you got to go there and got your hair cut, something to eat, cleaned up. Then got your weapons cleaned up, reissued your ammunition.
Yeah, so getting cleaned up, here's another snippet from Ian Toll's book about what the journalists saw the soldiers of Saipan, what they looked like, what they experienced as they were mustering off Saipan. He writes, after a week on Saipan, the American soldiers and Marines looked very much like the men who had conquered Guadalcanal 2 years earlier. They were gaunt, they were bearded, caked with mud and soot, habitually staring into the distance with a vacant, weary expression.
1,000-yard stare.
Totally. I mean, they marched in long columns, hugging the roadside ditches into which they would dive at the first indication of enemy fire, because it was so prevalent on an island that size. They did not salute an officer, because to do so would mark him as a preferred target for enemy snipers. And at dusk, every night, they would have dug deep foxholes and didn't stop to rest or eat until it was completed, because that was their shelter. And the nights were not dark or quiet at all. There was a scarred landscape that was lit by the star shells, the long burning parachute flares. The stillness was disturbed by the engines of tanks on the move and by the rattle of machine guns and whistle blasts of artillery shells. So that was his life while he was on Saipan, and he's not even done yet. He has a few more comments about what happened on Saipan, and then he still has to go to Tinian and invade that island next.
This concludes episode 2 of 8 in the Harvey Hunt series on the Warrior Next Door podcast. Join us next time for episode 3, where we will hear about Harvey's experience on Saipan as well as the invasion of Tinian.
Well, thanks for joining us. If you like what you hear, please like us at the Warrior Next Door podcast Facebook page. Feel free to post your questions, and we'll try to answer them in the next series of interviews that we do. All of our interviews are archived at the Veterans History Project, Library of Congress, and also with our partner at Grand Valley State University in Allendale, Michigan. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.